This is the time for our speaker to share her experience, strength, and hope for approximately 30 minutes. So yay, Maureen's going to be our speaker. Yes, thank you so much for being here.
Okay, my name's Maureen. I'm a compulsive overeater. I think everybody here knows me. The way I'm thinking about this is I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And the first 20 minutes, what it was like and what happened are going to kind of be intertwined, because when I think about it, I can't totally separate that out. So here we go, what it was like. And also just to tell you, I have a partially paralyzed vocal cord. And so I'm using the speaker. If anything goes awry, please let me know. If I take a lot of breaks to drink water or whatever, that's why. This is the first time I've spoken for 30 minutes since I had this condition. So let's say a prayer for the best. So I believe I became a compulsive overeater at the age of 8. Because when you look at pictures of me, I'm a pretty normal child size until I'm 8, and then I explode into a very obese child. Also because there were some really painful things that went on in my life at that time, and I turned to food. I do believe that I had a propensity to do that because I come from a family with a long line of drug addicts, compulsive overeaters, alcoholics. There's a lot of people in recovery in my family. So I think that propensity was there so that when things were difficult, I turned to a substance and my choice was food. And not to dwell on it a lot, but what happened was as a kid, I was already feeling less than and not a part of, because my mom had 5 kids in 6 years. And then she had a big gap, like 8 and a half years. And then I came along, and my family, we were pretty much in poverty back then. So my parents were working a lot, and each morning my sister would wrap me up in the bed blanket and carry me 2 houses down to the babysitter. And you know, and all growing up, I had these 5 brothers and sisters that were very bonded and had this whole different kind of childhood than I did. And they were teenagers, and I was just kind of little and in the way, and I didn't really feel a part of things. And my parents, God love them, they were working their asses off. They just were not around. And I became very, very bonded. Thank you, God, higher power, for this woman who cared for me, who I became so incredibly bonded with. And so when we moved, you know, I basically had lost my mom. She was, I'll talk about her as a grandma figure because she was quite older. Now I'm thinking, oh, she was probably 50, but I thought she was old back then. And the place that we moved to, there was a lot of trauma happening in my family. For me, I was bullied by the neighborhood kids, and it was very bad. I mean, I would leave my house and be physically accosted to the point where the neighborhood parents actually got together and said, this is abnormal, what's happening? You know, there were other things happening. My sister was molested by the man across the street. My parents prosecuted him. There were police involved, courts involved. There were the woman's wife, because he actually was put in jail, would come over to our house screaming. And all those years also, of the 5 siblings, 2 of them really, really were in that, like, she's just the pain in the ass, you know, little kid that stole all our thunder, and were really quite mean during those years. And then there were 3 who were like my parents, really. And one of them got drafted into Vietnam and actually was missing in action. One of them went away to college, and the other one just got a life. You know, she got her first job. She graduated from high school. She started, you know, college. She was still living at home. So I was really alone during all of this scary stuff. And I remember my sister she was a teenager. You know, she had she painted her room red and black. It was like this dark cave. And we had this little portable TV with the aluminum foil antenna, you know, and I just remember sitting on the bed with that TV in front of me eating, you know. And I do think that my family realized something was wrong, but they never talked to me about it. Like, I would overhear them talking about me. But in my family, my parents, they never abused any substance, but they lived with those rules that come from them having grown up in alcoholic homes, right? And one of them was, you don't talk about your feelings. So I learned to stuff all those feelings down. Food was my comfort. And also that dear woman that took care of me, she used to have me come and stay weekends with her. And I was still very bonded with her and her grandkids. And she would open the fridge and the freezer and say, look at these things that I bought for you, this food. It was like, that's how she expressed her love for me, you know? And then the only time I really had with my mom was grocery shopping on Friday nights. And she would buy me a special food item. And I would go home on Friday night and watch the Brady Bunch, Partridge Family, and Love American Style eating these foods. And so food sort of became my life at eight, and it stayed that way. It caused me to not be a part of my school experience. When I was in high school, I think in junior high, I went to one dance. I think in high school, I went to one football game. Other than that, I went and did what I had to do and came home and ate. I wrote some notes today of things that I wanted to kind of touch on. And the thing that really kept me in my food disease, both during that time and also after I found program, was the idea that tomorrow, you know, like I'm eating tonight, but tomorrow or Monday or when I get home from vacation, you know, and that really kept me in denial about the fact that this disease was ruining my life, because there was always going to be that tomorrow, which never came, of course. I had no idea how to live in today, and I had no idea how to change anything. Let's see, at 17, I went to my first OA meeting back in 1979. Yeah, I be old people. And it was very different then. It was Gray Sheet. You did Gray Sheet, which was a food plan written by our founder. I read somewhere that it was like our founder, Roseanne, and like a couple of ladies in a room who had no idea of nutrition or anything and just like made it. And then it became like the law at that time in program, at least in the meetings that I was attending. And so I was in my senior year of high school. I was very isolated. And I lost weight. I didn't have that much weight to lose. I have to say that during that time from 8 until 17, if you look at pictures of me, most of the time I was a pretty normal weight. But in my head, I was obese. And so I behaved that way. And when I say behave that way, I tried to hide and be invisible all the time. And the other thing I want to say about my obsession with food is it didn't and doesn't always manifest itself by obsession with overeating and overeating, the act of overeating. There's the flip side of being obsessed with whatever the food plan is, whatever the diet was, whatever the thing to change me was. So when I think about abstinence from food, it has two parts. It has abstinence in terms of the physical act of eating and working towards a normal body weight, and abstinence from constantly thinking about food. Like the idea is to live life with food in its proper place. So a lot of those years from 8 to 17, I really wasn't that heavy, but I thought I was. And it affected my life just as much as if I had been morbidly obese because of what my head was telling me. Let's see. So when I went in at 17, I followed the Gray Sheet. I think I went to my first meeting in like June, and I went away to college in August, end of August. And, you know, I'd gone maybe from like a size 14 or 16 to maybe a size 12 or 10 or whatever, but people reacted to me in a different way. And I think because, you know how I went to a pretty small high school. And so, you know, I have this little niche of the way that I behaved, which was I didn't interact with anybody, whatever. No, I would sit in a classroom full of people and never speak to the people sitting behind me, in front of me, or next to me the entire year. Unless it was something like you dropped your pencil, but I didn't say hello. I mean, I was pathologically shy, and it was all tied into my compulsive overeating. I had a friend who was a binge buddy, and we were joined at the hip. And every night we would call each other up. Usually we were together. We were always spending the night at each other's houses, but we both babysat, which was another binge party, right? And I started packing my own food when I babysat because I was so embarrassed that I couldn't stop eating all of their food. So I would like hide all this food in my purse or pretend it was a backpack with homework. But it really, most of my babysitting money just went to food. So there wasn't any financial gain. But it got me a place where I could eat right after the kids went to bed. And we would call each other up and say, the first thing we would say to each other was, were you good or bad? And we both knew what we meant. We knew it was tied in with food. And, you know, that was my perception of me, was I good or bad, depending on what I had that day. When I started the program with the gray sheet thing and lost that weight and went to college, it was very different. People responded to me differently. And I was trying to be in the social circle because my perception of myself, even though there wasn't that much weight loss, was that I was completely different now. And it didn't go well. I ended up not, I had no social skills, guys, zero. I was getting a lot of attention from guys. I had no idea what to do with that. And I can remember breaking my abstinence. So I'd been abstinent over the summer. And then it was like the first social event at this, I was in this huge, huge dorm. And, you know, the guy hurt my feelings that I actually had, you know, plans with. And I remember turning to the person sitting next to me and saying, you want to go to Jack in the Box? You know, it was just like, and there wasn't really any thought about it. It was just like, almost like when the doctor hits your knee and it goes, boop. It was like, oh, feelings, whoop, you know, here we go. And it was just overwhelming to me. And my response to that was to get married at like 19. It was like, let's just get out of this whole shit show that you don't know, excuse me, this whole situation that you don't know what to do with. So my disease really, really affected my life on a, such a deep level, big, big decisions, big, big lifestyle, totally not being who I was meant to be in any way, shape or form because of my obsession with food and my deep feeling that I was invisible, disposable, not good enough. And then for years in this program, like until the present day, it's really hard for me to say to you, I've been in program for this long, or I've been programming that long, because I was in and out. And I can't even tell you if I was more in or more out. It's just sort of like this blur. I can tell you that once I learned about this program, I was never the same, you know? And the first time I was in the program, it really was a diet. I mean, it was sort of like the program was kind of focused in that direction then, but also maybe I just wasn't hearing, you know, what I needed to hear, or I wasn't processing it. But I pretty much treated it like a diet, lost the weight, and then went back to eating. So during those years, I did get a lot of recovery. There were times when I was abstinent for a year and a half, working the steps, great sponsors. And that kind of recovery never totally leaves you. You know, it changed who I was as a person. I was much more a part of life, much more willing to interact in situations. If it wasn't a day after the night that I binge, you know, if I had a binge night, I woke up feeling like shit. I woke up feeling terrible. I woke up feeling drugged. I was just trying to get through the day without getting in trouble. I was always afraid of getting trouble for not being enough. So there was kind of this dichotomy of what I was like. And for a long time, my top weight was 240. And then, when I started, I don't know, maybe in the, I'm not even really sure at what year it was or whatever, but my top weight, which wasn't that long ago, was 273. So yeah, this disease was killing me. And I really lied to myself about that. You know, I wasn't taking any medications and I could be fairly active and so forth. So I really kind of was in denial about the level of physical disease that was going on in my life. Let me just look at my notes here. I didn't have a lot of persistence. You know, that was a lot of my problem, was I wasn't good at self-care. So therefore, program would slip away. And yes, maybe there was a little cockiness sometimes, like, okay, I don't really, I, but I don't remember ever really feeling like I don't need it anymore. I just remember it sort of slipping away because I would let other things come first. I'm definitely a caregiver. I'm definitely always concerned about what other people think. I definitely would take other people's opinions on as mine. And this all came from the lack of self-esteem growing up as a compulsive overeater. For example, I do remember one time making the decision, and it was because my partner at the time, he said that, well, if you tell yourself that you're a compulsive overeater and that once you eat, you're going to keep eating, well, then that's what's going to happen. Oh, you know, I mean, after years in program, you know, and I think really deep down, I just didn't want to risk, because I believed I was disposable, right? You know, I didn't want to risk, you know, losing him, which now looking back, it would have been like, wow, that might've been a really good thing. But because I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the three relationships that I have had, one being my husband, the first one was physically abusive. The second one, my partner was a sex addict and very emotionally abusive. And the third one, I don't even want to, it's too difficult to put a word to it, but I picked three very, I was only married once, but I mean, I'm talking like having a boyfriend that you actually have an exclusive relationship with. I never dated really. There's that part of my life is very small, you know, in terms of when I would get in a relationship, I was way too loyal and I would stay in it, you know, when I shouldn't have been in it, when it wasn't good for me, for really long periods of time. But I've never done and part of the problem was I never, because of this disease, went through the learning process that normal people go through when they date different people and realize how to be in a relationship, realize how to stand up for themselves, how to have boundaries, what is healthy and what's not. I never learned any of those things because I was at home in front of the TV watching the Partridge Family eating. And well, by the time I was dating age, I was watching Starsky and Hutch. I had a big crush on Hutch. And, you know, my binge buddy and I, we used to have these like major, major like conversations about relationships that we would have, that we would fast, you know. So is that 20, Richard? Rick? Okay, I'm going to guess that it is. And so, so I just didn't have a lot of experience and was very vulnerable to other people's opinions. And so that's that lack of self-care, lack of persistence, and then listening to other people were the reasons I think that I was in and out and in and out and in and out. And just plain old denial. And what it's like now is... well, this abstinence, okay, where's my phone? I have to put my things in notes because I don't remember this kind of stuff very well. So this abstinence that I have right now started May 30th of 2020. You know, overall, since my highest weight of 273, I've lost 119 pounds. This last abstinence starting 5/30/20, I've lost 91 of those pounds. I want to highlight that this thing that happened in the last, like maybe 3 years before this last abstinence started, which was I had lost a lot of weight. I was down to like maybe 202, down from like 273 down to 202. And then I was just like, I was working the program. I was having like, you know, like I would be abstinent for a few months and then have like a difficult week and then get abstinent again. But I mean, I was in it both feet working. And I gained 40 pounds in a year and didn't know it. That's how much I'm like this head that floats through space, disconnected from my body. And so when COVID started, I really lost the last shred of denial I had in the sense of, at that point, what was I at? 245. I was at 245 and I was like, wow, COVID says, you know, I was at 5 times more likelihood of dying from COVID if I got it because of my weight. And I think that was the piece that was like, wait, what? You know, because I was in such denial that I was healthy. So that was the impetus for this, you know, abstinence that started. And also, I work really well with the sponsor that I have. By the way, the reason I'm speaking today, I'm the speaker getter, and my sponsor suggested that I speak. And, you know, my gut said, no one's going to want to listen to me. You know, they're going to be like, oh, she's a speaker, you know, but I listen to my sponsor because she's very wise. And, you know, so here I am. But the thing that's been really good for me in this abstinence is my sponsor and my relationship. It's really a nice balance. I trust her. I listen to her. I try to take most of her directions. I'm not perfect at it, but also I am free to figure some things out on my own. You know, for me as a compulsive overeater all those years, I always just listened to what other people said. And so it's really part of recovery for me to go deep with writing, meditation, prayer, listening to people in this program to figure out what it is my higher power is saying to me and what it is that I need. It might not be what somebody else needs. Even if there's somebody with 30 years of abstinence who've been at goal weight for, you know, it doesn't matter. There are things that might be different. Now the steps, they're the steps. You know, I'm not rewriting the steps. I'm doing the steps. So, but all those other things and the way they're interpreted, you know, it's important for me to figure out what works for me. Having said that, I start every morning before I get out of bed, saying the first three steps and praying for three things. And the first one is that I be divorced from dishonesty. And I pray, I always try to look at the opposite, which is honesty. And so having said that, I need to find my own way, what works for me. It's very important that I be in honesty when I'm doing that, you know, that I'm not in denial, that I'm not looking for the easy way out, that I'm not just kind of responding to that, you know, because there is a part of me that's like, hey, you know, that when someone tells me what to do, that can rub me the wrong way. And so all of those things need to be put aside and I have to be really in that honest place where I'm really hearing my higher power's voice. And that comes from number one, abstinence. If I am not abstinent, I do not hear my higher power's voice. You know, my food is my God. And if I am talking to, you know, and I've always been a spiritual person, I'm always in contact with my higher power. But when I'm not abstinent, let's just say there's a lot of static on the line, you know. So that saves me, that the whole idea of that honesty. And as I said before, I mean, writing is really an incredible tool for me to get to that honesty. So many times when I sit down to write, I think, because I don't write every day, but I strive for that. But when I'm disturbed about something, I will turn to writing. And a lot of times it's like, you guys, I didn't even know what I was disturbed about. I would have told you, I'm disturbed because this person did this or that or the other, or I'm disturbed because I'm worried about this. And then I write and it's completely different. And I get a peace afterwards. And so I think I lived so many years disconnected from my feelings that, you know, I glom on to something that is maybe a familiar feeling or something that I assume is what I'm feeling. But it's that process of writing that really, really puts me back into what is really going on so I can be honest, so I can find my way. And then I also pray for to be divorced from self-obsession. Yeah, I'm one of those people that looks like I'm not self-obsessed. Like when I have said to friends, you know, I really struggle with self-obsession, they're like, you? Because I'm this caregiver, you know, I'm the one taking care of everybody and blah, blah, blah. But that is based in a self-obsession when I'm in fear, because I'm so afraid of being invisible, being disposed of, being alone, that I worry so much about what other people think, you know, and I worry so much that I'm not enough. So when I'm not good with my higher power, half of my brain, it's almost like when a computer has more than one program going, it's like there's all of this energy going into, what are they thinking about me? What do I need to say so that they think something good about me? And, you know, and so that's my form of self-obsession. And, you know, to the rest of the world, it looks like this really nice person doing really nice things for people. But, you know, for me, what I've learned in this program is it's your intention. You know, I can be doing the same behavior, which is being of service. And on one day, it can be because I've slipped into fear and self-obsession and I don't know it. And I'm doing it because I need you to like me, you know, and I'm off track. And that's going to lead me to the food. even though it looks like, hey, I'm doing service, I'm good. But if my intention is, this is what God guided to me to do, because I truly have the heart of service, or I truly have compassion for this person, then that's a whole different ballgame. So the intention behind my behaviors is really, really important to me. And so the opposite of the self-obsession would be, for me, not thinking about myself at all, because I really need to focus on self-care and self-love and self-acceptance. So it's self-love and love for others. That's what I pray for in that, you know, moment. And then the third thing I pray for every morning is to be divorced from self-will and in God's will. And, you know, I went through that whole thing of like feeling like, well, how am I going to be myself? And if I turn everything over to God, it's like I'm a nothing, you know, because in those growing up years with the compulsive overeating, I had no voice. You know, I really didn't have a voice, and I'm learning to have a voice, and that my voice is important and that it's okay to use it. But now I understand that being what God meant for me to be is the thing that will bring me the most joy. And that comes from doing God's will. So those are not two separate things. It's not like I'm going to do God's will and not be me. When I do God's will, I'm going to be me, who I'm meant to be. And that's going to bring me joy, and it's going to put me in line with God's will. And a lot of times, you know, that does involve service. So that's how I start each day. Usually before I get out of bed, that those prayers happen. I know I'm in trouble if I ever find myself thinking I'm going to do something. Like, it's not like I have to get everything done today, but that mindset of, I'm not going to deal with this issue right now that's dangerous for my program. I'm going to do it tomorrow. That's that thinking that will, you know, take me down. So even if it's something I can't maybe deal with today, my list of things to do is too long, or I don't have any clarity, then I put it in my God box. And I have complete faith that it will be dealt with. But there's no like, well, I'm just going to do this crappy behavior today, and then tomorrow I'll clean it up, because tomorrow never comes. And that, I think, is the reason why I've been able to be more persistent and more consistent and get more recovery in this program. A lot of it is, and you know, I've lost a lot of people. In the last 10 years, I have lost a lot of people to death. And I have learned there is no tomorrow. Don't wait for tomorrow, guys. Because, and some of those people were younger than me. You know, it's not, you know, a given that I'm going to be here when I'm 80 or 90. You know, so just do it. And if, you know, be who God wants you to be to the best of your ability today, because you don't have tomorrow. In terms of, you know, the little logistics of the program, which I think these are so different for different people, but just to say what it's like now, I weigh and measure most of my food and log it. I talked to my doctor about, and I have a registered dietitian out of UCLA that I'm working with related to my medical condition with my voice. And so I was able to talk to her also about what my calorie intake should be and what my goal weight should be and blah, blah, blah. And so I do weigh and measure my food most of the time. There are situations where I don't really know what I'm getting. And so it actually causes me more anxiety to sort of, so there are certain days when I don't, but I still report that food to my sponsor every day, texting. Okay, now I'm all done. And the only other little logistical thing is I weigh once a week, because for me, when I don't weigh, that just opens a whole door to denial. So for me, it's like my honesty. So I really thank you all for listening and for the honor of speaking here today, doing service for this program that has saved my life. So over and out.
Thank you so much, Maureen, for being of service. I needed to hear all of that today. So now time for questions and answers until 10:55 a.m. So that's another 9 minutes for shares. Thank you. Wow. My name is Stephanie. I'm a compulsive overeater, bulimic, and I do have a question. You know, I hear you say that, you know, what we're doing is we're setting aside everything we think we know, right, on a daily basis. And what things have you had to really set aside? What old beliefs have you had to set aside to really latch on to this new abstinence? What have you had to let go of that was really deeply rooted in a belief system that you drilled down into that got you this, you know, peace of God, if you will?
I think that finally letting go of the idea that I was disposable and had to people please, because oftentimes I wouldn't want to eat differently. I wouldn't want to call attention to myself in any way. I wouldn't want to be a pain in the butt to somebody by saying, no, I can't eat that, or I don't choose to eat that. So putting this program first, really, in everything, you know, but really believing that I am lovable. I can't really say that I believe that every moment of every day, but I do believe it enough to do the things that I need to do to take care of me and believe that the higher power will take care of the rest. And I will not end up alone and abandoned and invisible because I said, I don't want to eat at that restaurant, you know, that kind of thing, so that I can be more consistent about what I need. And I'm sure there are other things too, but that was the first thing that popped into my mind.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Very compulsive overeater. Maureen, you are awesome, for starters. I'm probably going to embarrass you, but you know, I got into this program 29 years ago and you were already an old timer and speaker. And I heard you speak. You were, at that time, drop-dead gorgeous, as you are today. And I remember so vividly, that was new and I was absorbing everything everyone was saying because it was so different than what I had believed. And one of the things that you said, you were Galway, and looking wonderful. And you said, I don't care who you are or how old you are in this program, unless you're 18, you will never have the body that you had when you were 18. And that's not important. You're going to lose your weight. Hopefully, if you work the program, you will. But this business of perfection is not something that I strive for at this point in time. I just want to be able to practice the principles of the program. And as you shared, you're so articulate and thoughtful. You know, I've known you for a long, long time now, in and out of program. And I'm so glad to see you come back because you have so much to give to us. And I'm so glad you shared today. But some of these words of wisdom that you have shared, I have taken to heart and I listen to and they're embedded in me because you are so thoughtful in your sharing, and I very, very much appreciate you in every possible way. You're an inspiration and a guiding light. When I hear you, I really do listen, and I'm glad you're here. You will always be ahead of me because you got in so much younger than me. I was 49. I was an old guy. And even you talked about even when you're 80. And I said, yeah, 80. Oh, wait a minute. I'm 79. I'm going to be 80. Which then reminds me that I only have today. I may be going to be 80. Maybe I'll maybe I will be 80, but I only have today. And today I want to work my program. I want to be abstinent. And I want to continue to know you and all the rest of the folks that are trudging this road to happy destiny. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much.
I'll jump in. This is Clementina. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for your active service and your inactive service, and which means Stephanie holding down the fort there. Thank you. And Maureen, I don't know what the rules are with this meeting anymore. Say something, don't say something, whatever. No disrespect to anyone, but I can't help but say thank you, putting yourself out there and being so honest with us and being that example. And what comes to mind for me is how long it takes to get where I am, how long it took me to get where I am, how many back and forths and ups and downs I've had. Little cha-cha steps, two forward, one back, 10 backwards, one forward, who knows? And because of that very thing, it really sometimes helps me to want to stick to my program. So I don't want to go through that again, you know, because this disorder is so cunning, baffling, and powerful that all that back and forth doesn't even matter to it. It still is seductive. You know what? You're doing so good. You could have one of those. No, thank you. Next. Oh, gosh, it takes what it takes. And, you know, I could not get abstinent all at once because it would have spoken to the anorexic side of me, the perfectionistic side of me. So my abstinence has been a result of, over the years, if you ask me how long am I abstinence? Well, 31 years on that, 5 years on that, 2 years on that, 1 year on that, a few months on that. And that's okay, because that's the beauty of OA. I get to do this my way with the power, with the help of my, the God of my non-understanding. And one day at a time, for real. And then I get to find out that we talk about the food, but it's not about the food. It's so ongoing. Thank God that we're here and we listen with ears on our hearts. Everybody have an abstinent week and namaste. Thanks again, Maureen. Did a beautiful job.
Ears on my heart. Thank you, Maureen. I'm delightful. Okay, so it is now time to close the meeting. Thanks to our speaker, Maureen. Thank you. Let's give Maureen a day. And to those who gave service, we welcome back anyone who wishes to attend, no matter where they are in the recovery. Would someone please read the promises? Socorro, do you
want to
read that?
Would love to. Thank you. Socorro, compulsive overeater, the promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you so much. Beautiful. After a moment of silent meditation, which to me means three deep breaths, connect with power greater than ourselves, and then the serenity prayer. God, give the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can.
Wisdom to know the difference.
I will not mind.
Thank you.
Come back. It works if you work it, and you're worth it. Yay.